Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you to LSE for this evening's hybrid event. It's the final event of this year's LSE Festival, Power and Politics. This festival is taking place all week, with a wider range of exploring how power and politics shape our world. My name is Ken Benoit, and I am the director of the Data Science Institute here at LSE. I am very pleased to be here to welcome tonight Chandrima, Sadiqa, and Neil, both to our online audience and to our audience here. Tonight's session is called AI Guardians: Who Holds the Power Over Our Data? Tonight we're going to be exploring this question of who holds power over our data. We're going to discuss ethics and bias in AI, the need for trust and transparency, and we're going to be asking who should be held accountable when an AI system causes harm due to bias or errors. Following the discussion, there will be the chance for you to put your questions to the panel. For our online audience, you can submit your questions via the Q&A feature. When you do so, please do include your name and affiliation. For those of you here in the theater, I will let you know when we will open the floor for questions. Please raise your hand and wait for the stewards, and they will get the roving microphone to you. Otherwise, no one will be able to hear you. I'll take a range of questions from both our online and our in-person audience. For those Twitter/X users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is #LSEFestival. I would ask you to please put your phones on silent so as to not disrupt the proceedings. The event tonight is being recorded and hopefully will be made available as a podcast subject to the absence of technical difficulties. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce our brilliant panel. Chandrima Ganguly is a data and AI ethicist working in the Chief Data Analytics Office within Lloyds Banking Group and has a background in AI ethics and theoretical physics. Neil Lawrence is the inaugural DeepMind Professor of Machine Learning at the University of Cambridge and the author of the book The Atomic Human. He'll be hosting a book signing outside the theater tonight following the discussion. And finally, Sadiqa Musa is the Senior Analytics Manager at Trustpilot and is the founder of Black in Data, where she is an advocate for increased representation of ethnic diversity within data. So, a starting question that I would put to each of you: who is in charge? Is it a multitude of actors? Are governments in charge? Or is anyone actually in charge?
All right. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you to all of you for giving up your Saturday evenings to hear us talk about this. In order to answer that question, I think I will probably refer to, short answer, I think it's a little bit more complicated than just naming one entity. The slightly longer answer, I think I will refer to a framework that I actually heard about today when I was talking to a friend of mine about coming to this panel. And this is a framework called the Algorithmic Ecology, which is put out by, March 2020, by Stop the LAPD Spying Coalition and the Free Radicals. And essentially, this framework was put out in response to PredPol, a predictive policing algorithm, that was going to be deployed in Skid Row in LA. And the way that they broke down the various stakeholders, some of whom are not human, involved in model or AI creation deployment, is the following. So at the lowest level, you have the community members, the people who are the data producers, the data owners, and also the subjects on whom AI is deployed. Just above that, you'd have the operational layer, so the entities who are responsible for deploying these algorithms. So in this case, it would have been the policing departments, et cetera, the people who actually use these AI algorithms. Above these, you have the institutions, and these institutions could be represented by academia, by tech companies, governments, regulators, and that's the institutional layer. And the layer above all of that is the ideological layer. And the ideological layer in this case would be, for policing, would be white supremacy, incarceration, and so on, that would in fact govern the actions of the institutions or the operational deployments. So to me, the question that is more important is that in this complicated network, not who holds the power for AI deployment, but rather who doesn't hold the power and who should hold the power. And for me, the people who are producing the raw materials that lead to the creation of AI models and to the deployment, that is the end user communities and the data producers, right at the bottom of the layer, so far have felt quite left out, have felt that their trust is on the line, have felt that they are not well represented in even the model objectives, often don't know what the use is of these models. And it is these groups that I feel should be holding the power more so than the rather complicated network of operational layers, institutional layers, governed by, frankly, biased or rather difficult ideologies that govern these interactions.
Very interesting. I don't know how I'm going to follow up on that. Because the way I see it sort of manifests in a day-to-day in my organization, I see the control simply lying in the hands of the applied AI producers. So we work in a day-to-day organization where literally everything that we do is created in silos. We have the power to pull data, create these learning and testing algorithms, and a lot of the time, our managers, our CEOs have absolutely no idea what we are doing. Unless we begin by being transparent and showing the details of what we are creating, the power is solely in the hands of the producer. And I loved what you said there about who should actually have the power. I think that is a more meaningful and impactful conversation that we should certainly be having, but the way it is actually manifesting right now in the working world, it is very much in the power of the producer.
Those were really great answers. And I think maybe if I stand back a little bit and say how I try and think about what's going on, what we're looking at is a fundamental change in our information infrastructure, where we're moving from the use of writing and books to control to the digital computer. And if you go all the way back to the invention of writing, the power was held by the scribes, the people who could read and write. And what's sort of interesting, and I think led to what John Dream was, I think, was nicely summarizing of this hierarchy, is over time, the people who had the power gained obligations alongside their power. So they became professions. The earliest people to write were accountants, not poets. And lawyers, civil administration. And over time, they had obligations within society. With the challenges, I think Chandrima was mentioning, that those obligations may have not represented the diversity of society. Mm-hmm. And that's where we've got to today, where we have a set of institutions that are supposed to be protecting individuals. But simultaneously, the rug has been pulled out from under their feet because the information infrastructure is no longer written in books. It's all digital. And the modern scribe is the software engineer. And they have none of these obligations. So as Sadiqa was saying, it's the applied AI people. Mm-hmm. But they're the ones that are causing the harms at scale. So when we look at the Horizon scandal, it's a misimplementation of an accounting system, the disempowerment of the sub-postmasters who previously had done their own accounts and actually were responsible because if they made errors, because they were their own errors. And now they were made responsible for a systems error. And I think one of the horrific things about the argument that we're seeing around AI at the moment is it's ignoring that fundamental thing, that this has been going on for 20 years and it's been encroaching on us. Brilliant set of lectures, Honora O'Neill, A Question of Trust, 2002, the Reith Lectures, talking about how process is replacing judgment and human accountability. And I think the people who should have the power, and so LSE, I'm sure this is a popular thing to do, as Karl Popper calls it, the piecemeal social engineers, the people within our institutions who understand their roles and understand that they're striving towards a better society, they're technically expert in their domain, and across the world they're working towards reforming and using these technologies for the ideal benefit. Now, we've utterly disempowered all those people and replaced it with a group of people who don't have these social concerns, are wielding power at scale, and are causing society tremendous damage. I want to then add to that, there are additional problems even with that system in some of the things that Chandrima was mentioning, around, you know, whether that system is fair or whether we've understood, like, whether that actually contains all the things we want our devised modern society to have. But that's the best we've got. And we're currently destroying it. And there's no existential technical risk from these technologies, but there is a societal existential risk. It's destroying our social mechanisms for enfranchisement.
There's a lot of issues there, indeed. So this is fascinating to be talking about both the expertise seems to be a recurrent theme. Mm-hmm. The people who hold the power are those with the expertise. Of course, the scribes are only as good as the amount of paper and time supplied to them to write those books. And I guess suppose if you had a printing press, you had the power to publish, but you also needed a distribution network and that infrastructure. And there's a lot behind the infrastructure as well. Which gets us around to the questions of really this issue about accountability. And it's fascinating that you were saying, you know, as you said, Sadiqa, the managers don't really understand what's going on in the room of the people who are doing the AI and managing the data. And I wonder how they feel about this issue of trust. So let's talk about trust. There was a recent survey based on Edelman data that I read this week that suggests that trust in companies building and selling AI tools has dropped to 53% compared to 61% 5 years ago. And in the United States, this was even more pronounced, falling from 50% to just 35%. So even if there were not issues with bias and fairness, people believe that there are issues with bias and fairness. And as you were saying, there may not be effectively that much of a difference. So how do we develop this trust? What's the key to making it so that people, possibly even within companies, believe that this lack of bias and fairness is present in the guardianship of our data?
Yeah, I'm happy to start, and I will probably leaning on my personal experiences and the experiences of the community that I serve, which is the Black community. Now, AI and or generative AI and the whole concept of AI is just mind-boggling, right? We think of it as this very, like somebody's, you know, very, very smart in the corner, they're doing completely insane things, right? So explainability of AI, for me, is the first step. Let's remove some of these super jargons that confuses and actually introduces fear into people's lives. If you don't understand something, how can you trust it? If trust is broken within the Black community, we will never adopt it. So automatically, you are completely alienating a huge chunk of society because of this lack of visibility, transparency, and explainability. So for me, that is the first step that we need to actually tackle, being able to remove some of those complex ideas that people have of AI being sort of just a space for people with PhDs or professors, no offense to PhDs and professors, but it needs to be understood by the person on the street or by my dad, for example. So he has these fears. He will say to me, Sadiqa, what exactly is data? And these are the people that are impacted by changes in AI and the growth in AI on a day-to-day basis. So encouraging our community to be involved in these spaces, making them comfortable around these ideas and these concepts may be a step in the right direction. Just a thought there.
No, I just want to totally agree with Sadiqa. And actually, when you do sit down with someone and explain the technology to someone from the street, they say much more sensible things than most of the supposed experts are saying.
Yeah.
Because their basic intuitions about what it means, because they tend to be grounded in real life.
Absolutely.
And a lot of the opinions we're hearing are from people who are just not grounded in real life. They're fantasy opinions that come from reading too much sci-fi.
Well, we love sci-fi.
We love sci-fi, but most of us are mature to realise it's just a story.
Absolutely.
You know, and that actually most of those stories set out in this nice way where everyone thinks they're going to have this amazing future rolled by robots, and then they all die. You know, it's weird. Do they not get to that bit, these people? I mean, and I think it's totally key. And I think that the only answer can be, and I mean, I think it was also Chandrima's point about the empowerment of the people at the bottom. And that first thing has to be... So one of the things that's interesting in the history of writing is you might expect writing would get simpler and more democratized, but it doesn't tend to in most societies. And there's shocking things that I learned reading a book on this, like that in Korean society, a simplified form of writing was developed in the 15th century to avoid using the Chinese script that was complex for people to use. One of the most beautiful forms of script, my understanding is it's called women and children's writing. And people are basically told, that's not formal enough to be used for law and religious purposes, right? You know, okay, you may be able to read and write, but you can't read and write properly. Because, of course, that's about the scribes protecting their domain, right? Rather than doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is using their knowledge in the good of the people, keeping people out. And you can see that process happening again with this lie that we're hearing that these technologies are too difficult for people to understand. No, the truth is, you just can't explain them very well and you can't relate to a normal person. And we need to explain them to Sadiqa's dad and my mum and everyone else. And then we get the right opinion about how we want to move forward with these technologies.
I completely agree with you both. I'm just going to add a little bit more to that. So in addition to explaining these technologies and people being able to understand how these technologies work, I also think we need to empower people to act. How can they intervene to feel like they can actually decide what is happening to their data when they are watching a video on TikTok and their usage data is being collected? Who gets a hold of that data? Where is their data being resold? The point is that these supply chains are now so complex that most companies don't even know where their data is ultimately ending up at the end of these supply chains. They don't know why this data is being collected and for what purpose this data is going to be used. Like recently, Meta put out this sort of announcement, very, very hidden, very much inside their privacy settings, saying if you don't opt out, then your data is going to be used to train Meta's generative AI models. Mm-hmm. Generative AI models for what? To do what? We don't know. So people were just objecting just based on the fact that everyone doesn't trust Meta, more or less, and doesn't trust them to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. So not only do we need to explain the technologies, we need to make people feel empowered, and we need to be transparent around the data and the model supply chains, and transparent around why we're collecting their data. I say we as a representative of a corporate profit-making entity, and also, not me personally, but why is this data being collected and what models are being trained on it, right?
I think what you're saying there is also key in terms of one of the things I think Sadiq was also saying earlier, that the managers don't understand, the decision makers understand. And what Mark Zuckerberg revealed just after the US election, that he doesn't understand either, because he said it was a crazy idea that misinformation had gone out. And it took them 10 months to find out they'd been manipulated by the Internet Research Agency. And a lot of this is because their systems are very, very poor quality.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason companies objected to the GDPR is not because it's horrifically difficult legislation. In fact, the more you look at that legislation, the more it just lists things that would be qualities of a good data system. Mm-hmm. I used to say that we should call them good data practice rules. You know, wouldn't it be great if we could delete customers' data if we needed to? You know, and people are like, oh, we can't do that. What kind of system have you built? You know, and these aren't like AI systems. These are just large-scale compute systems that people don't understand well. And the onus is on, like, you know, my field is computer science. The onus is on us, and that's what I've been researching, to build better tools and technologies to understand the complexity of the systems we're putting out there. Mm-hmm. But to also hold companies to account for the systems they're deploying that they don't seem to understand. Mm-hmm. Because it's at those multiple levels that the understanding isn't there in the senior decision makers either.
But the senior decision makers do actually decide the model objective. They may say that train this model to do X, right?
Yeah.
And that is not.
But they don't understand the consequences of that when it's deployed.
And they also don't know if this X is even useful for the people who are going to be using this model. Don't know if it's going to be useful for my mum or your dad.
No.
Probably not.
I guess for them it really doesn't matter as long as they're making the money and the profits, which is at the heart of it.
And that's the trouble, isn't it? Because, you know, we were talking a little bit in the green room earlier, and I think one of the sad things about these technologies and these capabilities, and we're hearing this record again with all these CEOs saying, oh, we're going to use this for medical benefit and for solving climate and for curing cancer. Like, none of these companies have any record of doing that because these are hard problems. The problems that we all have, that we would all like to be solved. And because they're hard problems, you don't get to make an enormous amount of money out of them. So companies focus on the problems you can make large money out of. And those are the problems that no one knew they had. So you invent a problem like people really need to watch short videos of people dancing. Let's solve that problem. And then you make a lot of money.
We all love TikTok, though. Come on.
I don't know. I've drawn the line at TikTok. I may be misrepresenting TikTok. I don't really use it.
No, but this is a really interesting point, though, about what you said initially about the fact that the conditions in which we regulate things being changed, or the social fabric being pulled out from underneath people who are scribes. Mm-hmm. Because governments and regulatory organizations haven't really stepped up, now we're suddenly expecting corporate profit-making entities to know how to regulate the flow of information or to make moral decisions.
And the worst is, we've spent $100 million on an AI safety institute with unclear aims, right, with a group of people who are not accountable to anyone, as part of a campaign to claim we're leading in an area, and we gave $10 million to our 19 regulators to equip them with the capabilities to deal with this technology. Right. That's shocking. And I'm afraid it's difficult because that's not going to be an election issue. But that's where we're at. These are the type of investments we've been making. Investments in things where we told everyone there's an AI bogeyman and we're going to fix it with a safety institute. There is not an AI bogeyman. There's an existing structural problem with society where certain entities are overempowered and not being held to account. We are very fortunate, though, that Digital Markets Competition and the Consumers Act was passed just before Parliament closed. And this is an extremely important piece of legislation that has also not been in the news, that does start giving our regulators some power. But the CMA is one of the most equipped regulators to deal with this in terms, because they've reformed post-Brexit, they've got a lot of new staff. Most of our regulators are struggling, and they're not being supported with the capabilities they need. And then also, teachers aren't being supported, and doctors aren't being supported. And I mean, it's difficult because this is all structural investment, right?
Neil, you mentioned this word accountability. I want to come back to that. I also want to inject a note of disagreement. There's so much agreement among this panel. Yeah. And,
apart from about TikTok, we don't agree about TikTok.
Yeah, so you want to go back to TikTok? Sorry.
Well, if you want an AI success story, if you watched the match last night, the Germany versus Scotland match, the second commentator from Scotland, I couldn't understand a word, but the simultaneous AI subtitles did, so that's quite an advance, the Scottish fellow.
Was it Ali McCoist?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So that's pretty advanced AI. We talked about trust, we talked about accountability, I want to come back to that, but my note is skepticism. So I know we're talking about the data supply chain is a very important concept. Mm-hmm. Understanding that, I think you could explain that to your dad, I think, mm-hmm. Data supply chain, probably, even though I'm not sure that, as I forget who mentioned it, but some of these companies not even sure where their data is going at the end of it because it's sold and resold and processed. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to algorithms, when it comes to understanding the models themselves, I'm a little skeptical. I mean, I'm a big proponent of the explainable AI, I don't know what you want to call it, movement. But that's a technical movement among scientists who are AI scientists and machine learning specialists who realize that just because you can download Llama 3 with 70 billion parameters doesn't mean you have any understanding of what these 70 billion parameters are and how they operate when fed input data. Yeah. That's an extremely complicated issue. So I suppose we're talking more about the data side here, given the topic of the panel, or are we talking about algorithms themselves?
So I guess my question to you would be, like, what do you think people need to understand about the algorithms in order to feel empowered? Do they need to know how to build Llama from scratch? I would argue no. Mm-hmm.
What would we need to make them understand in order to engender trust and understanding?
So one of the first things that I think we would need to do is probably not see these algorithms as, I don't know, a general purpose tool that's going to walk your dog and brush your hair, as well as, you know, translate the accent of somebody you don't understand. Like, perhaps the one thing that you need to tell people is that they're not magic, they're actually probabilistic. It's really hard to create assurances around it. Perhaps another thing to tell people is that the large amounts of training data that have gone into these algorithms are actually data that they themselves have generated. And there is no objective way to evaluate these algorithms to be good or bad. But there are ways that people can be empowered to evaluate them for specific purposes if they even find it useful. You can tell them that they can organize themselves in a way that they can create these data trusts, data intermediaries, etc., where they are able to hold in reserve not just training data, but evaluation data as well, that allows them to decide whether any of these models that are being deployed are actually useful for them. You can tell them about regulations and rules and where they can intervene and lobby their regulators or other authorities so that they can change the laws to make it more favorable to them. All these things you can tell them, but they don't need to know how to build a model.
So my first thing is I try and do this in the book. So,
Good point.
I think just building on those comments, which I think are great, I think one of the analogies I use in the book is that when people first flew to the moon, all these test pilots were then flying these guided missiles in collaboration with a computer. And of course, Armstrong did land Eagle on the moon, but he landed it by feeding instructions to a computer that then was feeding instructions to a set of thrusters. And the way those instructions were fed were through people understanding how pilots interacted with planes and quantifying that and giving Armstrong the sense that he was not flying a plane, but something analogous to that. And I think the problem that we've just been talking about is that in order to do that, the way that people need to understand these things is they need to understand them in relation to their affordances, what actions they can take and what consequences those actions will have on their lives or are likely to have. Now, we're right at the moment. We're in a position where we have zero affordances. We have very few actions we can take other than to opt out fully. And, you know, I think the notion of data trusts or data intermediaries, something that I've worked on a lot, is a really interesting idea there. So first of all, we have to have people having some means of holding, wielding power, being able to take an action on the system and knowing what that system will do, because that's kind of what they need to know. Like, a pilot doesn't need to know everything that's happening when they move the stick on the plane. They just need to know that as they push the stick left, the plane's going to bank left. I mean, well, you know, and a car driver's the same. So this level of understanding of, like, where people sort of go, no one understands these algorithms, first of all, that's just simply not true. And people understand them at different levels, and there are bits people are trying to work out. But I think, as was quite correctly put, the level of understanding that's required is not that they need to build an algorithm. They need to understand what it means for their lives and what decisions they can make to control that.
Okay. All right. So that, I mean, this idea of piloting is an interesting one. You mentioned that the people would trust them if they are useful for their lives. Being able to land a plane correctly under terrible conditions is something that's done through computer algorithms. Pilots use that, but a human can take over. But I'm sure that once cars start driving themselves, then people will be happy to take a nap and let their car pilot them to their destination. And they won't understand the algorithms, but they'll trust them based on their track record, I suppose.
They don't understand their cars at the moment either.
Exactly.
And also when, I don't know if anybody here has a fear of flying, but most people, I don't, but friends who have fears of flying really appreciate being able to see the route that the plane is taking on their screens. Mm-hmm. So that level of transparency also helps to build trust.
Okay, so giving people as much information as we can. Okay, I want to come back to something that you raised.
Well, is it as much information, or is it... I think we have to be careful, because too much information is also problematic. Talking to people, understanding what they want to know, and providing them with the information they want. So I think
relevant information.
Okay. All right, and different people are going to want different information.
Yeah, and that standard of relevance being set by the individuals.
Okay. And this is where the big problems are, because we've got to a stage where, you know, market economics is supposed to deliver solutions that are tailored to individuals, but the scale of the way the data works is we're getting solutions imposed by very, very large corporations. So what market economics should be doing is passing the information of what people want through the movement of money around the system. But when the way you make large-scale amounts of money is you just provide a one-size-fits-all solution for everyone, that isn't happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's happening at some level. And I think the urgent thing with this new wave of AI, what we need to do is make sure that commoditization level, that platform level, is happening in such a way that the solutions are reflective of what individuals want rather than what corporations think they can sell.
Okay. That leads me to a question I'd like to ask Sadiqa, which is, given your involvement in Black in data, you mentioned that the teams are the ones who really are the ones who are only the true folks who understand what's going on with the data, not even the managers, which suggests that it'd be very important to have diverse and inclusive teams. Is that a way to, because there's a form of lack of trust that something is not working properly, but there's also a lack of trust when a system exhibits bias.
Absolutely.
Is that something that diversity within the data pipeline can mitigate?
I think the heart of, I guess, the origins of Black in Data was to address that specific problem. We, as Black people in the UK, currently make up only 4% of data professionals, right? And if you're thinking about it in terms of applied AI scientists, we're only 1% of those people, those professionals in the UK. So this manifests many, many, many problems for us, right? Because we know, for example, if you take, I guess, a good example would be the gang matrix that the police, the Metropolitan Police currently have, right? Which is a list of what they consider very violent offenders that have gang affiliations. What we see with this particular database is 97% of the people that are on this database identify as Black or of ethnic minority backgrounds. And it's problematic because when there was great scrutiny of this metric, we found that over 40% of the individuals that are part of this large database are actually have zero affiliation to any criminality or any gang affiliations. Now, who created these databases? Who injected the information of young Black people into this system? The way I see it is because of the systemic racism that exists within the Metropolitan Police. That could be controversial for some, but is a statement of fact for the Black community, right? And so for me, actually advocating getting young Black people into this profession is very, very important. Our community is adversely affected by AI and technologies, whether it's the loan that we're given, or the facial recognition systems that are, you know, have high error rates because of misidentification of Black people, right? And that is sort of given huge problems in terms of community relations. If you're constantly stopped and searched based on an algorithm that is biased, how is that going to impact you on a day-to-day? The impact that it has on housing for the Black community, on loans that we get, on our own confidence, it's tremendous. So yes, getting people like me into the data business is very important because I don't look at Blackness and I don't equate Blackness to criminality, which is typically what we see happening in certain institutions, in certain systems. So yeah, it's super important to get more people in these systems.
Yeah, thanks so much for that. I completely agree with you regarding the fact that a lot of these systems do racialize Black and brown people. But the question that I think for me is that having diversity in development teams is probably just like the first step. And for me, one of the things that I guess I'll bring up, which is really close to my heart right now, and what I am worried about with AI deployment, is the increasing militarization that we see of AI algorithms. Right now, like today, I think, is actually a pretty important day for LSE. I was here a little bit earlier. I saw that there was a rally outside in LSE because I think the students have been asking their university to divest from companies that are responsible for climate breakdown and the proliferation of war, in their words, in the Palestinian genocide, for example. And this case is actually a really important case in my mind because we see the deployment of ethnicity detectors like Gospel and Lavender, and these algorithms are essentially designed to detect who is a civilian and who is not. And if we look at the reports of the deployment of these technologies, we see the operatives themselves say that they have been forced to, first of all, reach a quota of kills, and also they have been forced to trust the technology more than their own human judgment. And if we look at what kind of data was put into these technologies to train this, this was usually data that was collected without the consent of the people, the Palestinian civilians, the Palestinian people who were resisting the occupation, for example, on the ground. So then, to me, this brings up several issues, right? It's not just having representative data. And the field of AI ethics right now, as it stands, I think disproportionately focuses on having representation in development teams and in the training data. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the history of AI ethics, right, this started out as a movement of demilitarization. This started out as a movement of tech workers who were saying, we don't want our labor and our skills to be used to essentially murder people. Mm-hmm. So not only do we need representation in training data and in development teams, we need to empower our tech workers to also be able to, from these diverse teams, to sort of set the terms or the conditions in which these AI algorithms are deployed, and for what purpose. And I think, actually, to your point, Neil, like one of the things that I am most worried about with the deployment of AI is not that there's going to be some kind of super intelligent robot that's going to take over our lives. It's the fact that if we don't change the power dynamics and the balance in which AI is being deployed only in order to gain profit, we end up using it for some kind of horrible military purpose, like this.
And I think that's well put in both of your cases. And one of the things that's played out over the last 18 months as this weird argument around superintelligence AIs has dominated is I've been involved in this area for 10 years, and we've been super conscious to try and have representation of groups across races, across genders, across social classes, to try and make sure that we didn't make these errors. And almost overnight, the UK government started listening to 3 white men with a public school education and listening to them only. I was totally shocked, because we constantly talk about the history of this area, where when you look at the case of computer programming, which emerged initially from people who were skilled as telephone operators, moving jack plugs around. So it was often the work of women. And it was the work of women up until the point that people realized it was an important piece of work where people could be paid a lot of money. And then it shifted almost overnight to being dominated by men. And in this space of what I would call responsible AI, all the voices and interesting people, not all, but a large number of interesting voices have been, for example, women. And yet what we've heard in the press is also very aligned with this, or what we've heard from the government, has been utterly dominated by very few men, with very little experience, practical in building AI systems, very little experience in understanding societal issues, and yet that's dominated our policy in the UK. Now, I find that disturbing, because we all used to think, oh yeah, we've moved beyond that. We've moved beyond this thing that happened in the sort of 50s and 60s, where women were displaced out of the work that they'd been doing brilliantly for a number of years by a bunch of overconfident men who don't display Socratic wisdom, i.e. knowing what they don't know. And yet, at this most crucial juncture, as everyone's becoming aware of these technologies, we made exactly that error. And it's driven by the fact that the people who don't know what they don't know are really willing to step forward and tell everyone what the solution is.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Whereas the people who know what they don't know sort of say, look, we need to talk to the people who are being affected. We need to understand how this is being deployed. And of course, people want to have someone confidently saying this is the solution in that moment. And I think, to me, that kept me up so much. I was involved in lots of government advice, and we were all thrown out. All the UK government advisors were thrown out. And I was constantly working out how to stop this happening, because I think it's been devastating to the UK AI standing in the world. And yet, it just happened nevertheless. And so to watch that panning out in that process-driven way, to see the things that are just being talked about here, playing out in real time in our apparently enlightened modern society. It was just shocking for me. I mean, maybe what it wouldn't have been.
It's not a shock.
It's not a shock for a load of other people.
Not a shock. That is absolutely the standard. That is the norm. That is the reality that we live in. That's why we're constantly striving, pushing boundaries, trying to bang on doors to have access into these spaces. But it's absolutely not shocking. For me, as a black woman, I am always the only person in that room. Right? And I'm always getting spoken over. I've trained multiple people. I attend meetings and they ask the opinion of the white guy next to me when I am the one that's been training them for the last 5 years. These are completely normal experiences. I feel terrible that you found them quite shocking, but they're absolutely realities of the day-to-day.
I think I was shocked by them, not because I see them the day-to-day reality, but because we'd explicitly built an ecosystem with that in mind.
Yeah. And they totally ignored it.
We'd explicitly constructed everything with the knowledge that this was going to be a major issue, and we must not make that error. And it was dropped almost overnight.
But that's the ideological layer, right? White supremacy, colonialism. Unless we disrupt that ideological layer, we can build all the ecosystems we want.
I don't know. And maybe I'm naive. I feel it wasn't ideological. It's to do with panicking ministers. And then someone confidently striding into the room. And, you know, one of the interesting things about ChatGPT, I educate at Cambridge, so one of the things I think that you can see it's doing is it's emulated something that Oxbridge has spent years working out how to do, to produce graduates with very little experience of life who can intelligently argue on a variety of subjects and be fundamentally wrong in various aspects of it. But everyone finds the argument very satisfying and stimulating. This is an example of convergent evolution, because ChatGPT worked out how to do that in about 6 months.
Cambridge is my alma as well, but I get it.
But you see it all the time.
I know.
The place is filled with it.
I accept.
And of course now the whole place is going, oh my God, what are we going to do now? ChatGPT can do that. I mean, that's not how they describe it. The reason that came about is because, of course, it is effective to have a confident person saying, don't worry, listen to me, I'm speaking in a posh accent, I'm using long words. Yeah. People align around that. And I kind of think that this effect, even if we ignore the ideological things, this effect of having people who do that striding in at the moment when the government was panicking is also a major thing.
And you know what else I'll add to that? I kind of alluded to this in the example I gave when people were saying that, oh, trust the robot and don't trust your own judgment. Mm-hmm. I think in addition to this, there is like this tendency to rely on the technology's answer. And I feel like this has driven UK policy. It's like, you know, the AI is always right. And no matter what you can do as human intervention, your knowledge will always be inferior to, I guess, a statistical guess, which is as far as a model output comes out as. And this whole tendency for techno-solutionism we see also driving the Gen AI revolution right now.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to cut in there because I want to leave time for questions in our audience. But I'm going to let you get one last word each before we do that, a very short one each, where I think in the context of this discussion that we've had about how we can develop AI for social good and for social inclusiveness, a lot of the themes we've touched on, can you each name one really positive development for society, and then maybe one thing that is a chief worry that you have? And it can be in the context of what we've discussed.
No, good. I'm curious to hear what you have to say.
Okay. Positive developments for me. This week, I actually ended up getting a demo of an accessibility lab where people were developing generative AI technologies that allowed people with disabilities, such as people with deafness, etc., to use almost augment their life in some way. This can be positive. And I think that this lab had developed these technologies after gathering requirements from members of the deaf community. I will say a caveat this with the fact that as long as these technologies, again, sorry to sound like a broken record, remain in the hands of profit-making entities and are sold, I am a little bit worried about how far the benefit may spread. Another benefit, I think, is probably people starting to take open sourcing and commons licensing a bit more seriously, I feel, and I don't know if both of you would agree with that statement in recent times. And I think that's actually a major positive because given sort of the debacle that we've seen in past AI deployments, particularly people who face racialized violence, as you were mentioning, I think that has made people wake up a little bit more to the fact that we all sort of need to start, you know, taking a bit more agency and control over our data and the resources that are produced from it. So I think that's another sort of social positive I would see. And in terms of fears, I think we have spoken a lot about fears right now in the panel, but I guess the fear for me, chief amongst this, is that the way the ecosystem is working right now, the resources required to change the way AI deployment works still remains concentrated in the hands of a few, and our regulatory bodies and our governments don't seem to be, in my opinion, stepping up to the challenge of redistributing these resources. So I think a lot of responsibility ends up in, you know, in people like us, and I don't know about you, Neil, but I know that you and I, Sadiqa, we do this in our free time because we are ourselves not very resource rich, so it'll depend upon, you know, common people every day giving up their time to sort of build up these communities or these initiatives that put power back in the hands of, you know, common people. So that's a fear.
Okay, Neil, how about you? And shorter.
So on the positives and related to what Chandrima said, this next wave of technology has the potential to bring tremendous advantage in terms of it could, and the word is overused, but democratize the technology in terms of you're being given the ability to finally speak to your computer. We could get rid of software engineers. And that's the provocation I keep using with my colleagues. Let's make the only profession we replace software engineers. And let's keep the other professions.
Wait, this is the good thing or the bad?
No, that's what we should target. That's seriously what we should target. Because all what you're seeing at the moment is software engineers trying to protect their domain in the way that the scribes did and trying to say, no, this is too complicated. So our number one societal aim is let's eliminate software engineers. Let's not eliminate doctors, accountants. Because, you know, in theory, if this technology is going to do the things that they promise, people will be able to program their own things, right? You'll be able to develop apps that you want that serve you rather than something that's imposed upon you. If the technology can't do that basic thing, then don't tell me it's revolutionary in any shape. So that's the number one thing I'm working towards, making myself redundant as a software engineer. And I think that would be a great, I mean, it's got a lot of challenges with it. There were a lot of challenges with the printing press, with democratizing information topography under the printing press. It undermines security, all sorts of challenges. But I think it's for me, that's the thing to sort of aim for. The challenge, I think, is the same that was already said, is that I think you can do that through profit-making companies, but you need to regulate in such a way that those companies are smaller and less powerful and less controlling. And I think that what we're seeing at the moment is certainly very few governments are getting to grips with the seriousness of that, about how to, you know, when you've got your prime minister choosing to interview Elon Musk, who is probably representing, you know, clever though he is, one of the most problematic people in this space, then that kind of demonstrates the lack of understanding where the problem lies. And so that's my fear. But I genuinely think if we get this right, we could really start putting some of these things correct, you know, fix them to some extent.
I'll make mine super speedy. So what I am loving right now within the AI space is definitely around the health side of things. So I, similar to you, had a great friend that is an oncologist, and she's specializing in creating an algorithm that detects certain types of breast cancers. And this has been her life's work for the past 3 or 4 years, and I am seeing enormous strides in those spaces, which gives me a lot of pleasure in seeing, because I believe that's going to have an enormous impact on people, quality of lives, and so on. My biggest fear is also attached to, I guess, the healthcare system, is marginalized communities like ours also have the potential to continue to be left behind. In her training and testing data, where she's looking specifically at certain types of diseases, if we're not having enough testing within my community, again, it will potentially have adverse effects in the black and brown community. So we'll continue to be left behind if we are not part of these sort of analyses and decision-making tables. So I see enormous strides that have been made and positive strides, but I also see the impact and the potential dangers that can come from AI into the black communities.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So a wealth of opportunities ahead, but wealth creates inequality, and we need to avoid that. Okay, so we have a lot of questions here. We've got some online questions, but we've got some in the audience. Why don't we take this gentleman here and guess you with the dark shirt.
Great, thanks. Thanks for the panelists for your insights. Very interesting. My question is actually on the last point that Neil raised in terms of that you want AI technology at the end of the day to replace you, so which means you're not going to have any job. So there are a lot of good things that AI can do, but at the same time, just picking up on the points that you raised, at the moment we're seeing a lot of people losing their jobs because of AI. So this is something that we see on a day-to-day basis. So you go to a supermarket or you go to buy your clothes, all people who are selling, I mean, helping us to buy things are actually replaced by AI technology. So how do you see that going forward? But at the same time, one point to add is also recently we've heard Amazon shops, which was initially, we were told that it is AI-generated or AI-supported shops, but then at the end, we've learned that actually it's actually humans who are in India working or replacing those people who are actually, to put it in a simple way, as a shopkeepers. So the Amazon shop that we have in this country and other places as well, so you just go there, you scan your Amazon code, and you can just leave. On your wallet, the money is gone. But then at the end, we've realized actually there are people who are actually working. I mean, the whole job is actually outsourced in another country. So in terms of also to be very fair for those people who are working overseas, we're basically outsourcing pretty much all the jobs outside other countries. How do you see those kind of things?
Why don't we collect one or two more questions, and then we'll give our panelists a chance to answer. So just behind a previous questioner. There we go.
Hello, good evening. My name is Leonarda. Thank you very much for this very insightful panel. I'm studying international history, so it cannot really be further from what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis to what I've just heard. And hence, if you allow, two questions. So my first question would be for someone who is really new to this field, where would you say is a good starting point? Which tool can I learn? Where should I start searching online? How do I get familiar with AI? I mean, besides I'm using ChatGPT and ChatPDF occasionally. And then the second question, if you allow, what is your approach to mental health and everything that comes with sitting in front of a computer and then coding or just not necessarily being in an environment where a human was created to be in? Any tips or ideas regarding that? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. You should come to all the events of the LSE Data Science Institute that we offer, and that'll be a good starting point. I'm going to read one question from our online audience, and then we'll let our panelists address those, and then we'll take some more questions. So this is a question from Stephen Early, who is a data architect in our LSE IT division. He wants to know, why are you trying to put him out? No, I'm just kidding. His question is it already too late to affect a shift in the balance of power in the control of AI? Have we lost that battle already?
Maybe I'll start with Stephen's question, because it's the most recent. No, I mean, I think I'm a forever optimistic person, right? So I'm never going to be like, oh, it's too late, we just give up, etc. But no, and I, in all seriousness, I think this is because of what, you know, I think I was saying, and I think you've echoed that, Neil, is the potential for the democratization of this technology and the rise of open source. And also because if we can actually leverage these two things, and we can build sufficient critical literacy initiatives so that people are able to learn what they need to know and want to know about the technology, are able to come together to create communities in whatever sort of data intermediary structure is most applicable for that situation. And alongside that, if there are voices that empower regulators, then, you know, I think through that there is actually a fighting chance, because then we disrupt the flow of, well, the raw material to these models, right?
I'd agree with that, and I'll try and address some of the other questions. The Amazon jobs thing, I think what's going on is the training labelling is being done in India, I assume. I haven't read, but I know that system, and it is automated when you're in store. I know the people that built that, because I used to be at Amazon. But it's this point that Chandrian was making earlier, we're offshoring. So I think it's not just the work itself, it's the nature of the work we're going to ask people to do. So sit at this computer, label all this stuff. You know, and we're putting that offshore. There was an enormous amount of that work being done in Kenya by OpenAI, with people looking at really traumatic material, and then they also shut the place down. I mean, this is a real problem, because the labour is this very, it's very tedious. I mean, I think that relates to the mental health. So it's not just the changing of jobs. And I think one of the things that I find really annoying in this space is sitting in meetings where, because they're just listening to the three public schoolboys, what you're hearing about the future is, oh, it's going to change professionals' lives. Oh, lawyers, you know, who are the only people who in the past that used to translate English into legalese are going to be all out of work. Well, look, the history suggests that professionals are very capable of adapting to a technology and moving on. But it also suggests that people who are already on the margins of society, already in a job because they were made redundant from the coal mines, so they went into the call centres, or whatever, they have very few options. And I think it's really important that we are looking at those communities, because what's happened is that the politicians got freaked out because they realised that ChatGPT could do their job better than they can. Now, that's the way they're doing their job at the moment. If they get in touch with what they're supposed to be doing, which is using their humanity and their understanding of what people want to do their job, then we could all improve, but it will be disruptive. On the mental health thing, which I think is related, I think it's a really key question. You don't know how individuals do it. I make sure I spend quite a lot of time without electronic devices in the day, go for a morning walk, I don't take calls or anything like that, and I think that problem is going to get worse. It's a big problem in universities at the moment. We've got people not being able to switch off in their social lives. When we were young, you know, if people made fun of you or bullied you in the day, you could go home and no one's bothering you. They can carry on doing it online now, can't they? I mean, it's really problematic. There are some, of course, really interesting developments, Online Safety Act and these sort of things in scope there. A good starting point. I think that, you know, yes, there are lots of courses, as the LSE ones, there's lots of things online. The main starting point is find something you're passionate about that you want to work on, that you would like to fix in the world. AI is not a thing to work on in itself. This idea of solving intelligence I find ridiculous. It's a tool. Find what you're passionate about doing, and then try and see how AI might be able to help, or how machine learning can help. Do it that way around. Everyone's doing it the wrong way around.
You asked the lady there around tooling. So is it that you're thinking of getting into tech, if that is how I've read the question? No? You're just curious about the tools.
So, to reduce my fear of it, or sort of, if I'm the mum.
Okay.
Well. Read my book.
a good plug there.
That's
a good one to start. And I think what you touched on around the mental health side of things, I think, is really, really important. So for me, on top of finding what you love, what I ask myself is, when I am dead and gone, what would I like my legacy to be? What impact am I bringing to the table? How is the work that I am doing positively impacting the lives of others? That's the way that I keep my mental health really, really well. And secondly, I set myself boundaries. There are certain things that are so important to me that it is a no-go for you. I will create clear boundaries in terms of the people that I'm engaging with, the algorithms that I am building, and also making sure that I don't ever transgress those boundaries, and communicating those to people clearly. Switching off is also a key thing for me. Making sure that I take those rest days, no communications, go off to some, I'm a super introvert, so finding quiet time for me, alone time, is really, really important. So figure out what re-energizes you, what gives you energy, and also really being able to identify what also drains you, and try to avoid those things as well.
Okay, we have been generously signaled by my events manager that we have an additional couple of minutes. So we're going to collect two more questions and try to get very brief answers to them, because I know that people want to ask them. And then we're going to bring it to a close. So let's see. How about you waving your hand vigorously there? And we'll take one of the questions in the back. How about you in the center in the back? And we'll start with...
Good evening, all. It was wonderful to listen to you. My simple question is, with the advent and advancement of AI in the last 1.5 years, we have observed, or I have got from it, is there are more attackers than the defenders. So for the defenders part, we can embed, you know, a code of ethics when we develop such systems. But how are we going to address the attackers? And do we have governments or some agency or regulatory body looking into it? That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you. That was very insightful, this entire discussion. Could you please talk more about how we could democratize AI and its generation, its development going forward? Is it a problem of fundraising? What kind of regulation would we need? Can you have crowdfunding? Do we need to change how capital flows work, how intellectual property rights work? Why is it that some firms are concentrated? Is it because they're putting in too much personnel and manpower? Could you please just give a vision of the future, if you can, which could be a lot more positive than it is right now, in which we could have communities harnessing AI and the right people communicating how AI works to laypersons, rather than leaving it to corporates who don't really have an incentive to do that?
So my quick answer, I think both can be answered with the same thing. And I think it comes back to Popper's notion of piecemeal social engineers, that actually, if you educate people correctly, you don't even need a majority of people trying to do the right thing to have a tremendous effect. Because people trying to do the right thing naturally collaborate. They constantly question, am I doing the right thing? They do all the things Sadiq has been talking about, and they're constantly working to improve the way they're doing things if they display Socratic wisdom. And that's tremendously powerful. But what you need is those people to be empowered. And what's happening, and to me the key problem, is they've been disempowered by these technologies. So education at all levels, but bi-directional education as well. So listening to the people, that's really key. There's far too much telling people what the answers are, not enough listening to them, bringing them together in groups, having them share their problems and solutions, learning from that, and sharing best practice.
We can leave it there if you'd like, because pretty broad question. But if anyone has any last words...
So I think I really agree with what you're saying about the bidirectional education, particularly, because I think the way that we have been talking about AI is very much like there is somebody who holds the gold standard of knowledge, and then communities just have to learn from it. And that's really annoying. And
it needs to be the other way.
Exactly. Like, I mean, I think we should use educational methodologies like, you know, I always go back to Paulo Freire in this, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, where he talks about education not being a stream by which somebody tells something about an established truth to another group, but the group together learns about what the truth would be for them. And I think this is particularly important for AI, and I'm really curious to see new educational initiatives that are cropping up that try to disseminate what is needed to know and discover what is needed to know within that group. In addition, though, I do think that there needs to be some sort of support from sort of the governmental regulatory structure that allows these to blossom. And maybe academic institutions could be leading the charge on this. I don't know, because there's a lot of academic freedom that these institutions have.
That's what we try and do. AI at CAM is our initiative. I'm sure LSE are trying to do the same thing. Yeah. And one thing we need to do as universities is work together on this, not compete. Work across universities.
We have a lot of work to do, indeed, on this. I'm going to bring this discussion to a close, and I want to say that it's been my privilege as director of the DSI and as someone selected to chair this event and many of the other events that I've had the privilege of doing while I've been director of the Data Science Institute. And that's one of the things that makes my role most rewarding. It's been a great discussion. I think that we know a lot more, and we also know more about what we don't know, hopefully, as well. This was the last of the many events that's taken place during the LSE Festival Week. We hope that all of you have enjoyed the LSE Festival. And if you want to revisit, or if you missed any of the events, you should be able to see them on the LSE YouTube channel. podcasts from this event and of the other events will also be made available in the days to follow. I'll also mention that copies of Neil's book are available outside the theater, and Neil will be around for the signing. I would also invite you all to join us for a complimentary drink in the foyer to continue this conversation and to celebrate the end of this year's LSE Festival. I would also finally like to close this event by thanking not only our speakers today, but also some of the people behind this event who made the organization of the LSE Festival a success and all of this week's events possible. This includes Neil Lee, the chair of the LSE Festival Steering Group, plus Louise Jones, Antigone Bulagari, and all the rest of the staff who organized the festival. Please join me now in a final round of applause to thank our panelists and everyone.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.